This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. In Washington's Ponderay County and Idaho's neighboring Bonner County, a debate is on over a proposed silicon smelter proposed for just south of Newport. Supporters of the facility say the jobs are badly needed in an area that hasn't had a lot of good economic news in recent years. Opponents are skeptical about the benefits the region will actually see. They point to the potential harmful environmental effects. Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports.
The proposed smelter project by the Canadian company Hi-Test Silicon could bring an estimated 150 jobs to the northeast Washington community near the Idaho border. State Senator Shelley Short believes the project will be a great deal for the region.
It'll be the first new major employer in northeastern Washington in a very long time. They will be at full capacity, will be 150-ish full-time jobs.
But Bill Ellis, chairman of the group Citizens Against Newport Smelter, believes the number of jobs is exaggerated, as are claims that the jobs will be high-paying.
The average wage for the jobs that are going to be done there for people in the area is at best, $17 an hour, because there are no smelter people here. There are no engineers here, and it's arguable that their administration is going to be brought in.
Senator Short says it's likely that initially Hi-Test Silicon will have to spend some time training local people to work at the site.
For a short period of time, there are going to be people coming down because they're going to have to, mentor these people, if you will, to make sure that they understand how to run the equipment.
The smelter, which would produce silicon from the smelting of quartz, sand, and charcoal, qualified as a project of so-called statewide significance. That designation allowed the State Department of Commerce to provide $300,000 to the Ponderay Economic Development Council, which was then given to the company to jumpstart the project. But Bill Ellis says, ironically, that was exactly the same amount the company paid the Ponderay Public Utility District for the land to build on.
We've got hundreds of thousands of dollars being donated by the county or the state. And so they bought their land for free. It was sold to them at half price. And this started making people angry.
Senator Short says some of the money from the state is being used to defray the cost of an environmental analysis and feels the free land charges are overstated. Washington State Commerce Department spokesman Chris Green says the money given to Hi-Test comes with some strings attached.
There's contractual agreement language created whereby a company must perform and create those jobs within a certain period of time or pay the funding back to the EDC, which in turn repays it to the state.
But when it comes to the environmental concerns, many in the community worry about a silica smelter that will be releasing carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxide, and sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. Critics like Bill Ellis worry when they hear local officials saying the statewide significance designation will mean fast-tracking the project through the permitting process, especially when it comes to meeting environmental standards. Ecology Department spokeswoman Brooke Beeler says the normal State Environmental Policy Act, or SEPA, protocols will be adhered to without any type of expedited process.
No, there's no time criteria or time crunch associated with this particular project or a project that has statewide significance. It's something that we still have to make sure that we get through our processes, engage the public on each level, and ensure that the environment is protected at the end.
Besides the environmental impact, it appears the source of electrical power for the plant may require more than can be generated by the local Ponderay Public Utility District. While a spokeswoman for the utility would not go on tape, Kimberly Gentle was able to answer our questions in an email about the ability of the PUD to provide electricity to Hi-Test sand at the proposed smelter. The email says the PUD, quote, can supply power to the smelter either through market arrangements with third parties or through their own resources, depending on generation and load conditions. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
During the last week or so, climate scientist Steve Gann and other volunteers for the group Citizens Climate Lobby have been on the road throughout the inland Northwest. They've been giving presentations about what they see as the current and potential effects of climate change in the Northwest. The 12-stop tour coincides with the UN Climate Change Conference that wraps up Friday in Bonn, Germany. Dr. Gann works at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, and he's given presentations in cities as far west as Ellensburg, as far north as Omak and Twisp, as far south as the Tri-Cities in Walla Walla. Tonight, he and the rest of the group will be at Washington State University's campus in Spokane, and tomorrow evening at Sandpoint Community Hall. Joining them tonight, or at least this afternoon, for a presentation is Ellensburg physician Dr. Sarah Kate. Others are in Spokane as well, including John Sandvig, who is also a member of the Climate Lobby's Conservative Caucus. And now Dr. Gann and Mr. Sandvig are in the studio with us. Thanks for coming along and being with us today.
Thanks for giving us this chance.
Our pleasure.
So, Dr. Gann, tell us a little bit about what your research is all about in Richland.
I am a global climate modeler. I develop global climate models, and I use them to simulate past and future climate change. And a particular focus has been on the impact of warming on mountain snowpack, which is a critical natural resource for irrigation during the summer months that we rely upon for agriculture.
And what kinds of things are you finding?
We're finding that without action to reduce emissions, we can expect a 70% reduction in mountain snowpack in the western U.S.
Overall, total?
Overall. Now, larger reductions in moderate climates and smaller reductions in places where it's so cold that a little bit of warming doesn't make much difference.
So I think, and maybe my my perception is a little faulty, it seems like the snowpack is starting to melt off earlier, leaving us with drier conditions in the summer, which probably leads to our wildfire seasons that we've had over the last few years. Is that a faulty perception?
Certainly the snowpack has been declining. We see that in the data, and that is leading to drier moisture in the soil, and that can exacerbate wildfires. There are, of course, other effects that influence fires, like forest management, and so it's not clear which is the most important effect that's contributing to the increase in the fire area.
And certainly the Washington legislature this year passed a couple of bills that deal with forest, trying to improve the health of the forests in the Northwest. So let's talk about the Citizens Climate Lobby. John Sandvig, tell us a little bit about what your organization is all about.
Yeah, we are a virtually entirely volunteer organization. Sometimes people see the word lobby in our organization's title, and they think of K Street paid lobbyists. That's not at all what we are. We're all citizen volunteers. Our orientation is geared toward working with members of Congress on federal legislation, which is designed to do really three things. One is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions so that we get global warming under control. Second is to preserve a strong, or actually maybe even improve a strong economy and create a lot of jobs. And third, and maybe most important, is that it needs to be politically viable. So we are a nonpartisan organization that very purposefully tries to reach across the political spectrum, bridge the bipartisan divide that we see so much of in our society today, to build a political will for an enduring solution to climate change. So that's Citizens Climate Lobby, and I'm just one volunteer amongst thousands.
So you're a member of the Conservative Caucus. What does that mean?
Yeah, the Conservative Caucus is a group within CCL, which is oriented toward speaking to more conservative voters. There's an understanding amongst many people in the public that climate is somehow a liberal or progressive issue. And we believe fervently that it is not a liberal or progressive issue. It's not even a political issue. That there are many conservatives who also believe that climate is changing, that humans cause it, and that we need to do something about it. So the Conservative Caucus is oriented towards those members of the CCL organization who have an affinity to speak with other conservatives. And so that's kind of my orientation. I want to get this message out to conservatives because there's a sense that conservatives don't believe in this, and it's not true, and we want to grow those roles, while at the same time being open and accepting of all political persuasions, because we think everybody can get on board with our idea.
Okay, so collectively you've both been part of 10 other presentations over the last couple of weeks or so, and what has the reception been? Twisp and OMAC are very different places. You know, Walla Walla, a very conservative place. What sorts of reception are you getting?
So I would say the majority of the people that come to these presentations are on the liberal side of things. They do seem to be more concerned about climate change, but we also do get conservatives attending. And by and large, the vast majority of the people that attend these presentations come away filled with hope. They see a political path forward on this issue, and they're energized. We're actually starting at least 3 new chapters of CCL as a result of this tour.
If I may just add to Steve's remarks real quick, what I see is a huge appetite for understanding that a solution exists that can also help the economy and is politically viable. Much of our presentation, and I, you know, fair warning to your audience, we encourage them to come. But we talk about the changing climate and what causes it, and Steve is an expert in that discussion. But we also spend a fair bit of time talking about what to do about it, and in particular advertising a policy that we recommend, which we call carbon fee and dividends. So there's some policy discussion in our discussions, and what has been interesting and very gratifying to me is the fact that the audience are listening raptly to that part of the discussion. It's kind of a wonky thing that sometimes people don't want to hear, that kind of thing, right? But they seem to be eating it up.
So let's dig into that. The rhetoric in past climate change talks have been about cap and trade and about carbon taxes. What is a carbon fee and dividend?
Yeah, so carbon fee is distinct from a carbon tax in one key feature. We call it a fee and not a tax because all of the revenue that's gathered is returned to the households. It's all returned. Now, when I say that, I exaggerate only a little bit because there are some administrative fees, but they're a couple percent. So the idea is put a fee on fossil fuel when it comes out of the ground. You charge it at the extractor right at that point, and then those costs or expenses flow down through the value chain, right? They're just embedded in the economy. You don't need to track it from that point. Expenses go up, though, because fossil fuel becomes more expensive, which is exactly what we want. But all those revenues are coming back in equal proportion to everybody in the country. Everybody gets a dividend check. You know, at some interval, monthly, quarterly, yearly, that's for Congress to decide. But so while their expenses are going up, their income is going up in roughly proportion. You know, in the aggregate, as expenses go up, income is going up as well. So people's standard of living is not damaged. So then you ask, well, okay, so what's the incentive to get off carbon, get off fossil fuel? The fact is, though, that you have then a built-in incentive because the market is telling you that fossil fuel is expensive. If you can reduce your carbon footprint, you're still going to get that same dividend check, so you can actually pocket some money, so there's an incentive there. But the biggest feature is the fact that fossil fuel becomes relatively more and more expensive over time, and so alternate fuels, alternate energy sources become more and more affordable over time. At some point, there's a crossover, and the alternate forms become cheaper. Everybody uses them. Fossil fuel is done at that point. And let me backtrack a moment because I think I neglected to say that not only do you put a fee on fossil fuel where it comes out of the ground, you increase that fee every year. So it's continuously increasing price. Then there are a couple other features, but that's the basis of it, and it's really quite simple.
So help me follow the money. I'm trying to put together a mental picture in my head. Let's go to, let's say, North Dakota, where where oil is. Oil comes out of the ground in North Dakota. It is sold to some sort of distributor or some sort of company that refines the oil. Is that where the tax is imposed?
Well, no, we would apply it at the extractor. So the firm that pumps the oil and collects it in, you know, those big tanks and puts it into the pipeline, that company would pay the fee. And once it's paid, it's just in the cost structure of that business's product that they sell downstream. The next person in the value chain that has to buy that product, you know, maybe it's a maybe it's a manufacturing plant, maybe it's a power plant, you know, that cost
is
embedded
passed along
as a price to the next person in the chain.
So where does the tax go to?
It's a fee, not a tax.
I'm sorry. Where does the money go?
Where does the money go? It's collected by government. It's paid by those extractors to government, and government pays it back to the citizens as a dividend check on a regular basis. So it all comes back to the people.
So
government keeps nothing.
Do you get the same dividend whether or not you buy a lot of gas versus a little bit of gas?
Yes. Everybody gets the same dividend. So if you have if you consume a lot of fossil fuel energy, you know, I sometimes say that gives you a large carbon footprint. You know, you're going to pay more for your energy than you get back in the dividend. On average, if you're kind of the average consumer, the average fossil fuel consumer, you're going to get back the same amount that you pay in increased expenses. So you're going to have a net balance in your pocketbook. If, on the other hand, you're a low carbon user, a low energy consumer, you're going to get that same dividend check back that everybody else does, but you have lower expenses. You're going to actually pocket some money. So there's an incentive to get off fossil fuel there.
So this is a tax that would be it would be a federal tax? Federal fee.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll call it what you like.
Yeah.
The idea is that it is revenue neutral and that the money comes back to households is crucial to this concept. And it is by its nature federal in its scope. And that's really for two reasons. One is you could do something similar on a state-by-state basis. In fact, the people last year who conceived of Carbon Law wanted to make this something similar. Hard to do it on a state-by-state basis because of differences at the state boundaries. When you do it on a nationwide basis, you don't have concerns about business leakage across state boundaries. For example, that's just one feature. And so the federal government implements this. And that introduces the third component that is fairly important to understand. We call it border adjustments. And it has to do with keeping U.S. producers competitive in international markets. And conversely, making sure that international producers don't have an advantage in U.S. markets. And there's another aspect to this, which is that it encourages other governments around the world to adopt similar policies for very financial economic reasons. And, this is a global problem, so we need a policy that will have global impact, and this does.
So you made reference to this. It's called a border adjustment. So foreign oil comes into the United States. How is that fee applied?
Yeah, oil is easy. Oil is clearly fossil fuel.
And people understand it.
That has the fee applied to it instantly and obviously when it comes across, when it's imported to the United States. That's easy to understand. The more difficult thing to understand is what about – let's flip the discussion for a moment and think about exports from the U.S. Let's say an automobile, for instance, which has a fair bit of – energy in its production, right? So there's a bunch of fossil fuel consumed in order to build a car and, get it off the assembly line. Those expenses are going to be higher because we're charging a fossil fuel fee. If you want to sell that car internationally, holy smokes, your costs have gone up. And to maintain profit, your price is going to go up. That would seem to destroy that international market for your product. So we don't want that. We're not going to allow U.S. producers to be at any kind of disadvantage. So when they export, when that product leaves the United States for sale internationally in a region that does not have a carbon fee, the carbon fees that have been charged would be rebated at the moment of export. The exporter would get that rebate, and that offsets his costs so he can sell it at a lower price, or to put it another way, the same price he would have sold at if there were no carbon fees.
Yeah.
Okay, so equal and equitable competition, in the U.S. market, equal and equitable competition in international markets. U.S. producers are at no disadvantage. International producers are at no advantage to sell in the U.S.
So in our last three or four minutes here, Steve, so who in the political process likes this and who doesn't like this? How is the sell job to Congress?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There is now a caucus in the House called Climate Solutions Caucus. It's composed of equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats by design, and it now has 60 members. And this is one of the solutions to climate change that they are considering. We, as Citizens Climate Lobby, we meet with members of Congress twice a year. We just actually met on Tuesday and had confidential discussions with them, so I can't say what everybody's saying in private. But we've seen definitely Congress-wide shift towards action on climate change since CCL got started 10 years ago.
And so how would you characterize the speed of whether or not something like this would be taken up by Congress, might be enacted by Congress? Are you thinking a few years? Are you thinking a generation?
Oh, far faster than a generation.
Okay.
Yeah. No, there's been a very substantial shift, much less resistance to action on climate change, and a broader acceptance of the carbon fee and dividend by both Democrats and Republicans.
The Climate Solutions Caucus that Steve referred to has grown to three times the size it was on Election Day last year. We've had to actually change our charts during the 2 weeks that we've done this tour because of people being added to the caucus. So, as he described, that requires at least one Republican for each bipartisan pair. So, you know, the momentum is toward getting on board with some kind of climate legislation.
And how does the U.S. decision to pull out of the Paris Agreement affect this? Does it change the will to be able to do this?
Not in Congress. Now, certainly the presidency is a problem there, but that can change. And we look forward to the day that it does.
Well, you've got the Washington and Oregon governors going to Bonn and signaling their support for that.
Yeah, I think there's evidence that the act of having withdrawn from that agreement has energized people across the spectrum to take action in other ways, even if the administration won't. And we see that in cities, communities, businesses. You know, some are saying that that the U.S. will meet its climate targets under the agreement, even if the government doesn't support it. And, you know, that's wonderful, but not good enough. We need to pull together on this.
Yeah, beyond Paris, actually, to save the Greenland ice, which would raise sea level 20 feet.
Well, thank you for coming in. So we have Steve Gann and John Sandvig, who are volunteers for the Citizens Climate Lobby, and they have an event from 4 until 5:30 at the Washington State University Spokane campus today, and then tonight from 7 until 8:30, and then tomorrow, Friday, at the Sandpoint Community Hall from 5:30 until 7 p.m. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. It's heard Thursdays at noon on KPBX and at 5 p.m. on KSFC. You can hear podcasts of our programs or its individual segments online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to the Inland Journal page. A reminder that listener support allows you to us to produce and air this program and others like it. Thanks for your contributions. Next week, we're going to hear from researchers in Spokane who are looking into some of the more fundamental questions about why we need sleep. I'm Doug Nadvornik for Inland Journal.